The Guardian.
You know, the question becomes, do we need police? Is police going to give us ultimate safety? And our opinion, no, police are not going to give us safety. We've seen time and time again that actually what they do is provide death. But the question then becomes, well, what do we need then? What do we put in place for the police?
Welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and today we're looking at the links between Black Lives Matter and the Indigenous justice movement in Australia. This year, the Sydney Peace Prize Committee announced that the 2017 prize would not go to a person, but to a movement. Black Lives Matter was founded in 2012 by Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cullors. Patrice joined a conversation with Guardian reporter Calla Walquist and Aboriginal activist Latoya Rule, whose brother Wayne Morrison died in custody last year. Calla started the conversation by asking Patrice how Black Lives Matter started.
I was sitting in a hotel room when George Zimmerman was acquitted of the murder of Trayvon Martin. I was in shock. I didn't want to believe that this country would allow for a young Black boy to be murdered and the murderer to be let off. Even as someone who doesn't believe in jails or prisons, I just knew that he would receive some sort of sentence. And when he didn't, I went into full-on organizer mode. And more importantly, I went into sort of like this deep need to challenge and push back the rhetoric that we were in a post-racial America because of the Obama administration. And so I went onto social media and I went to look for what people were saying, specifically Black people. I wanted to know what we were thinking, where we were at, what was the next step, were we going to hit the streets? And I found a love letter, a love note from Alicia Garza, and she closed it off, Black Lives Matter, and I put a hashtag on it because I knew that in this generation, the hashtag can communicate a conversation across borders, across race, across gender. And that really is the birth of the hashtag that would then develop into a political project that would then be taken on as our movement call to action that would then what is now a network, Black Lives Matter, the network, which is 50 chapters across the globe, including Canada, including the UK. Folks are using it in Brazil. Folks are using it across the world. Black people are using it to stand up and say anti-Black racism exists here and we're going to fight back against it.
Latoya, what was your reaction when you first started seeing this Black Lives Matter movement come out of the US as a Wiradjuri, Maori and Gurungai woman?
Yeah, look, for me, seeing the Black Lives Matter movement coming up was quite refreshing and exciting as well for, like Patrice said, where we could take it here in Australia. We identify as Aboriginal people, usually as Black people as well. And so I love that this Black Lives Matter movement crosses over boundaries, like Patrice said, and tries to incorporate what I would call Indigenous and Native voices as well, which is really important in the movement that we've got, which is against colonial white patriarchy and genocide in Australia. So yeah, it's really important for us, I think, to, you know, adopt something of the Black Lives Matter movement for our struggles as well.
Latoya, you became more prominent, I suppose, in your activism after the death in custody of your brother at Yatala Prison last year. Can you talk about what that experience was like and what response you had after that incident occurred?
Yeah, look, my brother was in custody, so on remand without conviction for 6 days. And he had no prior convictions and he'd never been to prison before. And so he was put in a medium to maximum security prison in a division that was quite a serious division with quite serious offenders. And after an alleged altercation occurred, my brother was left brain dead in a hospital in intensive care and up to 5 prison guards apparently were involved in the immediate altercation, so they ended up going home that night. 3 days after that, or 2.5, my brother passed away because we had to turn off his life support. We've never lost anybody in this way in our family, as I imagine no black family wants to do, or any family wants to do, but, you know, given our history and relationship to police in our, I guess, colonial struggles, I definitely saw it as an issue connected to the race of my brother. And I think that, you know, this construction of Aboriginal deaths in custody has almost become a system that's become manageable. So my brother's death, you know, immediately after the corrections minister the chief of corrections came out and made a statement and very much stereotyped my brother as a dangerous criminal, despite, again, those non-convictions. So, you know, going through that process of losing my brother, but also the process of thinking about my brother as an Aboriginal man and, you know, part of this system now of Aboriginal deaths in custody, it just kind of grew something in me to stand up more so and have to take on this fight against what Patrice is also taking on, something that we don't necessarily want to take up, but the fight against, you know, racism and the fight against these kind of tools that and systems that I believe, you know, have been designed to kill us from kind of the beginning of when Australia was colonized.
Latoya, I want to just offer my condolences. When you lose someone that is close to you, it's unbearable, but losing someone to the state, no one understands that unless you've been through it. And so I just want to just offer my condolences and just let you know that, you know, here in stateside, that we were in deep solidarity with you and your family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Patrice, I wanted to touch on that outrage you mentioned, that no one was charged over the death of Trayvon Martin. It really mirrors the outrage felt by some in Australia over the fact that no one, police officer or prison guard, has ever been convicted over the death in custody of an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person. The closest would be the trial of Chris Hurley for the manslaughter of Murrunji Dumunji, and he was acquitted. Why do you think there have been so few convictions?
I think there's a couple things. The notion of criminality is almost always about black people. And so if you're not black, and mostly if you're white or white passing, you're not marked with criminality. George Zimmerman was seen as a hero. He was seen as someone protecting and defending himself. Black people are always seen as the aggressors. We are always seen as the ones that have to be, that folks have to protect themselves from. And so you'll always have that imbalance if an officer or a vigilante kills black people. We don't have the supports in the criminal justice system. In fact, the criminal justice system is directly built to denigrate and decimate us and our communities. So I think that that's important context. Why no convictions? I mean, there has been some convictions lately, and that has everything to do with our movement. I'm going to take, you know, a lot of pride in our movement being able to push the needle. But will convictions change the deep-seated racism in police departments? Will convictions change people's deep-seated racism? No, it won't. We can't jail away racism. We can't jail away patriarchy. But what we can do is push and challenge our local administrations, our local government, to defund law enforcement, to divest from law enforcement. And that is about a longer, deeper vision around how we decide, black people in particular, decide what our community should be invested in. stateside what you've seen over the last 30, 40 years is the growth of the prison system. And that isn't just jails and prisons. That means the growth of the police. That means the growth of courts. And that means the growth of new laws that criminalize Black people's everyday life. And so the response for us, you know, a short-term response is conviction. But the long-term response is defund. The long-term response is divest and reinvest. And that's pretty simple, you know. We want Black people to have access to healthy food. We want Black people to have access to shelter. Los Angeles homeless population is 50,000 people. Most of those people are Black people. Black people are the highest homeless population in LA. And so our work is about reimagining public safety. Our work is about investing in a multiracial democracy.
There was a comment made at the recent interview you did for TED with both Alicia and Opal, where you spoke, the conversation was about rather than having trickle-down justice, having an effervescence, a bubble up, a focus on those people who were most adversely affected by institutional bias and structural racism in the justice system, and addressing the system to make it fairer for them in order that it then becomes fairer for all.
Yeah. You know, the complicated part of this is, you know, the question becomes, do we need police? Is police going to give us ultimate safety? And our opinion, no, police are not going to give us safety. We've seen time and time again that actually what they do is provide death. But the question then becomes, well, what do we need then? What do we put in place of the police? What are the real responses to harm and violence in our communities? And I think there are some places where we could become innovative. In our country, police are the first responders to people with psychiatric issues. Police are the first responders to drug use and overdose. Police are the first responders to issues of domestic violence. And what we've seen time and time again, when they become the first responders, they don't de-escalate. They actually escalate. And what we've seen is when they become the first responders, our family members end up dying. And so how about our first responder be a social worker, a healthcare provider, someone who's a counselor or a peer, someone who in the community we've developed enough trust that a neighbor can come over and say, hey, I hear something's going on. What support do you need? That actually requires a different way of relating to people. It requires us to see our neighbors versus be suspicious of our neighbors. And so what you'll see with Black Lives Matter, it's not just about hitting the streets or direct action. We're trying to it's a humanizing project. We're trying to reimagine humanity and bring us to a place where we can decide how we want to be in relationship to one another versus being criminalizing our neighbors or being punitive towards them.
Latoya, what do you think of that in an Australian and New Zealand context?
Yeah, I'll agree with Patrice and say that Australia, I believe, uses policing and also the construction of prisons simply as a state of surveillance and putting a white gaze on, I guess, Black bodies. So throughout our Black history, especially Aboriginal people have been targeted in these ways of regulation. And we can also see that through the Northern Territory Emergency Response, or what is now the Emergency Intervention, and the policing and the bringing in of, you know, the army to have to deal with what was supposedly an Aboriginal cultural issue. I think that these structures are quite purposeful in the regulation of, you know, crime or what I would say is Black identities or Aboriginality, and to construct what is trying to be a one nation of Australia. So traditionally our Aboriginal communities, you know, really favoured what Patrice is talking about, which is connection and community, and coming together and relying on each other. But what we have in Australia now is a liberal state that favours individualism and capitalism. Aboriginal peoples are really anti-capitalism in their foundation and in our community. So, you know, the system of self-determination up against neoliberalism, it just is really an oxymoron. They don't go together. And Aboriginal sovereignty really isn't going to be recognised with any policing state or any, you know, any prisons. Particularly for me, I'm really admire somebody like Angela Davis, who talks about prison reform, you know, and closing of prisons. And actually the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody from the 90s spoke particularly about the issue of Aboriginal incarceration needing to be as a last resort. So, you know, we know that prisons don't work for Aboriginal people.
Latoya, you mentioned in the past that your brother's death was followed within days by the non-fatal shooting of Dennis Doolan in Cowra, footage of which was posted on Facebook. And a week after that, an older man was shot, again not fatally, in an altercation with police in Broome. Last Friday, another Aboriginal man, Chad Riley, died after being tasered by police outside Officeworks in Perth, Western Australia. WA being a state where Kevin Spratt was tasered 41 times by police inside the Perth Watch House in 2008. But as you say, there's often limited media attention. That push to draw attention to acts of violence that are commonly overlooked has been a focus of the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly the Say Her Name campaign, hasn't it, Patrice?
That's correct. You know, for us, the Say Her Name campaign was an intervention because although we were getting a significant amount of media coverage to talk about the deaths of Black people, Black people by law enforcement, it was about Black men. And we knew that women, unfortunately, daughters, cousins, mothers, nieces were also dying at the hands of law enforcement. And that we wanted to have a fuller conversation about who those people were. And Kimberly Crenshaw, who's one of our favorites, a part of, you know, the larger movement for Black Lives, she's been on the forefront, her BYP 100, Black Lives Matter. We've been really talking about and uplifting the women who've been killed by law enforcement.
The Say Her Name campaign was adopted in Australia as well by the family of Yamatji woman Miss Dew, who died in police custody in Port Hedland, Western Australia in 2014. And I know that those channels, the networks in the US, were used by the family to both draw international attention and also get that feeling of support and solidarity about common issues across the globe. Was that one of the aims of the Black Lives Matter movement when it was started up?
Yes. For us as three Black women, two of which are queer, openly queer, one who's a daughter of Nigerian immigrants, we stepped into the conversation about Black liberation really as in the intersections. We've always believed that when you center those at the margins, Black communities who are most at the margins, when you put them at the center of the conversation and you fight for them, you fight like hell for them, we knew that that could be the endpoint to liberation for all of us. And so you'll see as Black Lives Matter, the leadership is Black. Queer women, Black trans women, the leadership are folks who've been incarcerated, who are disabled, Black people who are homeless, Black people who are poor. This is a movement for all Black lives, and that is it's so important. It's important in how we understand how we build this movement, but it's also important to understand how we fight in this movement as well.
It's not uncommon when you're watching the Black Lives Matter movement from afar to see it described as a group of radicals linked to violent protests, linked to damage and things that are normally described as riots. But I know that the way that you're talking about it now is sort of very thoughtful and considered, and Is there a disconnect, do you think, between what the movement is and how the movement is portrayed, or sometimes are those kind of riots and loud, noisy, violent actions necessary?
There's always going to be an organic response to a boot on your neck. You can only put a boot on the neck of a community for so long until they decide collectively, which is often organically, to fight back and to rise up. But let me put some stuff in perspective, because for us, you know, I think that the, you know, sort of the pinnacle of our movement happens in Ferguson. You know, we show up in the streets after Trayvon Martin. But then the people of St. Louis and the people of Ferguson stay in the streets. Their first act was not an uprising. Their first act was a vigil. They had just witnessed a murder in their community. They had just witnessed serious neglect of Mike Brown. He was laid out on the concrete for 4.5 hours in the hot sun. And they were grieving. They were grieving. And so the community stood up and said, no, we're not going out like this. And they had a vigil, and the response to the community was tasers, was rubber bullets, and was tear gas and tanks. That was response to a Black community grieving. And so that's the very, you know, this is the conversation about law enforcement. They don't ever de-escalate. They are always escalating. And in this situation, what should have happened is there should have been care and grace for the community who just witnessed the murder. But instead, there was tanks and guns. And this is why we call for divestment.
Yeah, I would say that in response to Kala's question, that actually the Australian media have portrayed, from what I've been reading my thesis that I'm writing at the moment on Aboriginal deaths in custody and media portrayals of this particular issue about the riots and about the construction of deviance and the construction of criminality in Aboriginal people who have passed through the Aboriginal deaths in custody system. It was found in Australian media, at least, that they actually mostly portrayed Black Lives Matter as new wave civil rights activists in a civil rights movement in America, and were able to construct kind of the Black Lives Matter uprisings in the same vein as criticizing American governments and targeting the American government about, you know, the issue they have in their Black communities. Whereas in Australia, we were definitely constructed and have been historically constructed as deviant, criminal and violent. And so particularly in the case of TJ Hickey, who passed in Redfern after being impaled on a fence, after being chased by police for absolutely no reason at all, his family and his community chose to, you know, march the streets and were portrayed as rioters throughout our media. And so we now know that that instance was actually linked to police and what they would call a drug bust of heroin. And so, you know, these issues that have been constructed in the media of Aboriginal people in Australia particularly usually have an underlying kind of reason or motive behind them, whereas our depiction in the media of overseas kind of, you know, protests, as I would call them, or, you know, movements, you know, they're usually seen in quite a different light than we would see here in Australia.
That point about protests or movements springing from a moment of grief is really interesting. The most recent Australian example would be the riot outside the courthouse the day after Elijah Doherty, a 14-year-old Aboriginal boy, died in Kalgoorlie. The manslaughter trial over his death will be held in Perth in July. At the time, there was commentary that riots were sort of a last-ditch attempt to be heard by people who are otherwise voiceless. Was there an element of that at Ferguson?
Yeah. You know, I really think, and I've been in, you know, for me, the movement didn't start with Trayvon. You know, I know a lot of folks say we started the Black Lives Matter movement, but that is the, it's an iteration of our movement. The movement, this global movement for Black liberation started a long time ago, you know, and it started in different places and different contexts. For us in the States, it started when the first Black folks were, you know, brought to the American shores. This is a long fight against, you know, slavery, against the Black codes, against Jim Crow, against the war on drugs, against the ways in which this country has continued to devalue and decimate Black communities. And so I think our work is to imagine what's possible. Just recently, for Mother's Day, we led a national bailout campaign that was envisioned by Mary Hooks, who's a part of the Movement for Black Lives. Mary said, you know, we talk a good game about abolition, and there's Mother's Day coming up. I think the best abolitionist Mother's Day gift we can give to Black women is bailing them out of jail. And we bailed out over 100 Black women across 20 cities. Some of the best work I've ever seen in the 17 years I've been a part of this work. It is practical, tangible, and, you know, it's a, like a middle finger up to the system who, you know, a lot of these mothers were in because of drug use. They were in because they got stopped taking their babies to go to the beach and they their license was suspended. This is the sort of everyday violations of Black life. And we often don't talk about how it relates to women. And so I say that because I think this conversation about our movement is one, it's global. We have to talk about our global movement. We have to talk about our relationship to Black folks in Brazil. We have to talk about our relationship to Aboriginal folks and Maori folks. We have to talk about our relationship to Afro-Latinos, to Black folks who are undocumented from, you know, the continent of Africa. And we are. We're doing it both in our theory, but we're also doing it in our practice. And it's powerful. It's powerful when you get to be a part of a movement that's trying to make global connections. And then the last thing I'll say is, theory is really great, but we also have to build power and be practical about how we build it, and inspire our folks and be inspiring in how we build actions.
On that note of trying to make a practical difference, has there been a push to try and lobby politicians in the US and try and address that sort of tough on crime approach that seems almost ground into US politics and increasingly ground into Australian politics?
Yes. You know, for us, the first 3 years of this movement, many folks were like, what's the policy shift? What's the policy shift, right? And we were like, policy doesn't change culture necessarily. You could change laws all day, you could create new laws, and you could still have Jim Crow hate. And so the question became for us, especially in this new era under 45 and his regime, is how do we both build out the culture? You know, for me, BLM is an intervention into our culture, and also create platforms that can build power in our jurisdictions. So what you'll see is you've seen a lot of Black Lives Matter organizers and activists show up and call on local elected officials to do the right thing, to stand on the right side of history. But you're also seeing a lot of Black Lives Matter members decide to run for office and to build a campaign around them running for office. And you're seeing it in Jackson, Mississippi with Chokwe Lumumba, who is will probably be the mayor of Jackson in June. And that's huge because Mississippi is a red state and they do not want, you know, Chokwe Lumumba, who is the son of Chokwe Lumumba, who died when in his first year as mayor. They don't want to see him become the mayor. They definitely don't want to see him develop a socialist agenda inside of Jackson. And so what you're seeing is a multi-pronged approach to building out power.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Lines. You can subscribe by going to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app. We're on Spotify now as well. And please take the time to leave us a review. It helps more people find out about the podcast. It really does help. This episode was produced by Miles Martignoni.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.